Hello and welcome back to PaleoCast. My name is Dave Marshall and this is the first of a two-part episode on the Los Hoyas Lagersteta. For this interview, I'm joined by Francisco José Poyato Ariza and Angela Delgado Buscaglione, both from the Autonomous University of Madrid and who have just published the book Las Hoyas, a Cretaceous Wetland through the publisher File Verlag. But as usual, before we jump into this episode, we have our PaleoCast admin to get through. Firstly, the recording of the Paleontological Association meeting in Lyon. It was a great success, even if we weren't able to bring it to you live, which was unfortunately out of our control. All the videos from the conference are now available on our YouTube channel, so please subscribe to that if you haven't done so already. The new lapel microphone we bought for the conferences is really making all of the difference to the sound quality, so thanks to everyone that's donated to the show, especially those of you who make a monthly contribution. It really does help. Secondly, the virtual Natural History Museum. We have all of the website architecture now complete, so we're starting to curate content to put on display. We'd love to hear from anyone interested in donating their time to the project. So if you're an academic that could write a museum display on your favourite fossil group, or if you could help out just collecting multimedia for us, please contact dave@vnhm.org and we'll put you to work on what will doubtlessly be the greatest digital museum ever built. Finally, from the whole PaleoCast team, we wish you a happy 2017. Don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Twitter, and keep the interview requests coming in. This episode on Las Hoyas was one, and so it shows that we do listen and try to deliver. The second part of this interview will be out in 2 weeks, so keep your eyes out for that, and we hope you enjoy part one in the meantime. So Francisco and Angela, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you, David, for your intention.
Okay, so the thing that we like to do when we have new interviewees onto PaleoCast is understand who they are and how they got to be a paleontologist. So can you tell us what your route was into becoming a paleontologist and also what your research interests are?
Well, we got into paleontology through biology, so we are not geologists, and mostly we're interested in evolution. So that was my really expecting interest was to reach or to get some knowledge on how morphology in organism change, and then we, particularly I, go through systematics, and that's the point. I'm a specialist in crocodiles, so my very first works are on crocodile phylogeny.
Okay.
I made my PhD on fishes, so I stuck into fishes. And sure. I came to paleontology, biology as well. I'm also a paleobiologist.
And so you'd still consider yourself a biologist that looks into the past rather than an actual paleontologist now? Or is it hard Is it hard to draw a line? Do you just see yourself on a spectrum?
It is, because after all, you're dealing with living things, no matter if they are just a carcass or a fossil. So we are interested on the living animals and plants that were behind the fossils, that produced the fossils. So it is more difficult to restore an organism from a fossil than from a real body, or an ecosystem even more. But the aim is the same, to understand how organisms are, how they function, how they change, and how ecosystems work. And are constructed.
Okay, so the ecosystem that we're going to reconstruct in this episode is called Las Hoyas. So I think it would be a good idea to take us through actually how it was discovered before we get into what it actually is. So when and where was it found?
Was found in 1984 and was a casual founding. But they, in fact, the area is a hilly area nearby Cuenca. Cuenca is placed in the east center of Spain, not far from Madrid. And this area was very peculiar because it's a natural space with many different types of trees. And but then the soil was removed. And the earth, the slabs, I mean the carbonatic slab with fossils appear after plunging the area for forestal development. So somebody took these slabs for building in the city for make houses covering the house. Or making paths in the gardens, and one amateur find the fossils. So it was a kind of
a chain, and the amateur got in contact with a local geology teacher, and he got in contact with a paleontologist in Madrid. So it was really a chain of events.
Do you know what the first fossil found actually was?
I think they were fishes, plants, and crabs.
Yeah, fishes, plants, crabs. Probably one tiny salamander, as far as I remember. And very early, at that moment, appears also Iberomesornis, the bird, the Enantiornithina bird.
A bird, wow. So did the... paleontologists at the museum that finally got their hands on this, did they say, wow, this is amazing straight away? Did they know as soon as they saw those fossils that this was an important site?
Yeah, totally. In fact, the specimens were shown in one of the University of Madrid, La Complutense, and they carried the material to mammalogists. And then the mammalogist said, no, this is not my specialty.
It was the late Nieves López who worked on mammals for a long time.
Yeah. And then, but that day was there José Luis Sanz, and his work has been devoted to reptiles. So he saw the material and he said, yes, this is probably an amphibious. And salamander, and is Mesozoic. So it was so quick, the recognition of the relevance of Las Hoyas.
And so did it all come from the salamander and the bird that were found really quickly? I mean, how many important fossils were discovered initially? Was it just loads of fish and plants and just a couple of salamanders and birds, or was it full of important fossils?
Well, the thing is that the local amateur, Armando Díaz Romeral, he was very, very handy finding fossils, and he was working on his own for some time. Because he was local, he had time to go to the locality. So he was finding on his side a good load of specimens, and among them is where Iberomesornis was found. And our first field, let's say, recognition trip was in 86. And already in that trip, we found quite a bunch of fossils. So the richness is such that just by one day looking for fossils, you can find, you can realize how important it is.
So if you took us into the field right now, what would it look like?
Well, the area is, as I told you, is natural and also has a protection by the autonomic laws. So it's a point of interest nowadays. So the area is covered really by trees, and we have been working there during 30 years. So now the locality itself is flat. I mean, it's a kind of bold space where you can see the lithograph, the limestones, the carbonatic limestone fully exposed. But at the very early beginning of the field trip was plenty of move slabs. So it was very difficult to follow a layer or to make some field work, because you have to split every slab you found. Now, after we have removed the soil and we have cleaned the space, you can go to make a field work, a systematic field work, digging layer by layer. So you can get the fossil exposed, and not one fossil exposed, you get the whole association exposed.
That's pretty nice. That paleoecological information can often make all the difference. So,
it really does.
How often are you able to actually find them then? Are they, if we have just the layer of limestone, as you said, just stripped back, are they really common? Can you see them every meter or so, fossils?
You can see quite often you can see dozens of fossils in a square meter. So it's really rich.
And are they easy to spot? So if we just went out and had a look down by our feet, are they like dark splodges on a white limestone, or are they a bit more subtle? Are they really easy to see?
Well, the complete ones, which are quite a bunch of them, are very easily distinguished. The color is very characteristic, and they are easily spotted. The problem comes with smaller isolated remains, like small parts. There are many small parts. They can be difficult, but the students, after a couple of days on the field, they just get used to recognize practically anything.
It sounds like quite a nice place to work, if I'm being honest. I can imagine it in the sunshine, being able to spot hundreds of fossils.
Well, you're talking about Spanish sunshine in July, so maybe it's not so comfortable.
Oh, right. Well, it's snowing here currently in the UK, so I'm imagining a nice warm field trip would be quite nice. Right, so let's have a look at talk about some of the details of Las Hoyas. So what age does this Largestetta, the site of special preservation, represent?
Well, the age of Las Hoyas is Upper Barremian, and it was is based on the charophytes, on the ostracod associations, the palynomorphs also. The area, Las Hoyas, the site, is belongs to Formación La Huérguina, which is a continental deposits that was deposit in succession in the graben areas of the Jurassic, marine Jurassic limestones.
And geologists already knew the formation for some time before Las Hoyas was discovered. So from the geological point of view, the area and the formation were already studied by the time Las Hoyas were discovered.
Sure. So the fact that we have a Largestetta in the Upper Barremian, which is part of the Lower Cretaceous, is that significant? Do we have other sites of special preservation at this age or close to this age?
Well, there are, of course, other Largestetta of similar age, but we think none of them are really as rich and as informative as Las Hoyas is. So for the early Cretaceous is certainly one of the most important Lagerstätte. Certainly in Europe, of course. If we go to China, then that's another story. But for Europe, yes, it's one of the top early Cretaceous Lagerstätte.
Yes, the Las Ollas is what is singular in Las Ollas is that in a very narrow space, and also in a very short time interval, you can see clearly the very rich biota, early Cretaceous biota. So we have all the parameters control for this space and this time interval. And ecologically, you can also have many information. So this is one of the main interest in still working in this locality.
Okay, so considering things like continental drift, where was Las Hoyas positioned in the Cretaceous? Was it roughly around the same latitude?
No. For the Barremian, you have to think about that the Iberian Plate was an isolated island within the Tethys Sea. And the placement of this island was between 25, 30 degrees north.
So it should be where the Canary Islands are nowadays, more or less.
Yeah, at the position with Canary Island are nowadays, yes. So it's the placement was more subtropical. And then you have a peculiar paleogeographic condition in the climate, which was a subtropical and climate with very strong seasonality, and also within a maritime regime, because it was an island, and then the temperature was high by then, so you have precipitation and a high degree of evaporation, and that is a very starting, this is the very starting point to understand the ecosystem.
Yeah, did that have a big effect on the fauna and flora? So if you have just all of these animals and plants just on an island, isolated from everything, then they could perhaps have taken their own evolutionary routes, which their relatives on the continent might not have gone down. Do we see that the taxa at Las Hoyas are particularly different from other places in continental Europe?
Yeah, you really got the point. In the last 5 or 10 years, we are beginning to think of Las Hoyas as a laboratory of evolution, because you can really have information about the space and the time when the processes were working. And of course, isolation, both in terrestrial and in aquatic animals and plants, is a key element. There are many endemisms, for instance. So it's really very interesting for a paleobiologist from an evolutionary point of view.
But also you can see when you make the taxonomy of some of the vertebrates, there are many adaptations, peculiar adaptations. For instance, you have the frogs, which are pipoids, xenonurans, with very long hands for swimming. You have a crocodile, and this small crocodile, which was related to the Atoposaurid family, probably is a diving crocodile, also with a strong adaptation for swimming. So there are many peculiarities in the anatomy of many vertebrates that we did not realize before. But now, once we have think about the ecosystem and the peculiarity of being a wetland in an island, we think makes a lot of sense to have this endemic and also organism with strong and strange adaptations.
You've mentioned that it's a wetland there. So if we got in our time machine and went back to Las Hoyas, what would it look like?
It will look like the front cover of the book. So, from the very beginning, as we said, we knew about the geology of the formation. So we already had clues about the continentality of the locality. And then all the data that we've been finding were in accordance with this continental origin. So from a general point of view, it would look very much, we think it would look very much like a recent wetland, with patches of land, patches of water, like very mosaic-like, with very, very many microhabitats. What we see when we do the systematic fieldwork is that associations can change in time and in space. So it's really a very complex ecosystem. You will have vegetation, like land vegetation, a little farther away, but this would be covered by low vegetation on the land patches, and then streams of water, ponds, small lakes, what we call river of charophytes. So it would be a very varied and changing landscape.
So you have also to add to this landscape that the topography would be very flat, very smooth. And also, since the Cretaceous deposit were overlying the Jurassic marine limestone, this limestone calcified, and then you have a karstic system also and in the underground of this wetland. So you have karstic groundwater also feeding the area, or feeding the
water.
The water, no. So finally, you have to include the seasonality, strong summer and humid winters.
It sounds like a pretty unique place. So has there been any debate over these interpretations, or is it completely obvious that this is exactly the situation that we have?
Well, it's not really a unique place. There is a clear analog, recent analog. Was we think always in Everglades, in Florida, or in Belize, it would look like Everglades. So it's not so strange. And the discussion about that, yes, at the very beginning, some researcher not working in the area thought that it could be a marine, or it could have a marine influence. But in fact, you have all these facies are continental facies. You have a mosaic of lacustrine, palustrine, alluvial facies, which denotes a clear continentality, but also you have the fauna, and the fauna is made of frogs, made of salamanders, many insects.
Insect larvae like dipterans or odonata.
Plants. You have also charophytes. So the complete fauna is clearly a continental biota. So probably at the beginning was a kind of discussion about the marine influence, but nowadays I don't think so.
And just to make sure, we did the isotope thing in time, so we had the strontium and oxygen and all those isotope work.
Okay, so just before we get to the kinds of fauna and flora that we find there, I just want to have a talk about the taphonomy of Las Hayas and really work out how the fossils are preserved. So what fossilization routes have they taken? How are they preserved?
Well, the fossilization of Las Hayas is mediated by the presence of microbial mats, clearly. So we have made several studies on taphonomy, but not taking a look to the composition of the fossils or the or how fossil diagenesis occur. But we study the whole association in according the different types of microphases. So at the time we made the excavation and we control all the specimens, we also made a sedimentological control. So then after we put together the information from sedimentology and from paleontology, and we can recognize what is the kind of association in number, in abundance, in taxonomy of different wet or dry phases. So in that sense, we can clearly recognize that for the drier periods, there are a high number of fossils, and these dry periods are related also to microbial mats. So what we think is that mats would act a trap. So for the wetter period, what we found is isolated but very diverse fossils, but the number of fossils are very, very poor. And but that time, if you check the microphases, you cannot recognize any microbial mat.
How do you tell if a fossil was preserved in one of the dry or one of the wet seasons?
By putting together all the field information, all the data collected in the field, and you can see that there are two different kinds of associations, which are not necessarily one after the other. They are alternating. So you have to take a long time. That's why it has taken so many years of studying it. You have to take a long time to correlate or to relate the different levels one to another. But drier and wetter, or different associations, are intercalated throughout time and throughout space. But this is the same type of association you can find the same type of association throughout all the layers. So you have some layers, one association, some layers of the other, some layers of the first one, some other layers of the second one, and so on and so forth. It's very cyclic pattern.
So you've got the changing of the seasons to consider, and then you've also got the patchwork landscape of the wetlands. Was it incredibly difficult to figure out the paleo environment?
Yes, it was. As a matter of fact, at the very beginning, we had quite a number of laughs, because we began to realize that, well, there you find more crabs, and over there you find more plants, and a little farther you will find maybe a frog, maybe frogs. So you could really tell that different fossils appeared in different places, and so that was very strange from the very beginning. And the only way to make a coherent ecological model is really a wetland. You don't see the taphonomic and ecologic directionality of a lake, in other words.
Was there any transportation of the fossils? Were they found in situ, or had they been disturbed in any way?
Well, the only groups that we found with kind of transportation are plants, and these plants are not complete. but not the aquatic plants. So then you have the aquatic plants are fully preserved, and then for the aquatic plants, charophytes, you can find out charophytes with the germinative ends. So they're very diversified. There are seven species of charophyte, and you find complete individuals, and also angiosperm, aquatic angiosperm, such as Monsechia vidali. So those group of plants are really nicely preserved. But the other ferns, conifers, mosses are not complete. So we think that this group came from marginal areas of the wetland into Las Hoyas, into the marginal pond of Las Hoyas.
And same goes for the animals. Aquatic animals are preserved complete in fine detail, like they were protected very early on after death. And those that were more terrestrial are, first of all, they are very rare, and then they tend to represent the isolated remains that we find. Like isolated teeth or more fragmentary remains. So they are aquatic, are autochthonous, and terrestrial organisms are what we call para-autochthonous. So they were transported over a very short distance.
And has there been any taphonomic alteration in so much as have they changed in the 125 million years since the Barremian period?
Well, in taphonomy, we've been starting with the first phases of fossilizations. So we've been studying microbial mats and all that. Diagenesis is very complex. You can find, we are, the next step in taphonomic research will be about diagenesis. It's really complex. You can really see different signals of very different diagenetic processes. So yes, they have been altered in many different ways throughout time.
Are the fossils often preserved in three dimensions, or are they just completely squished flat?
No, the fossils are preserved bidimensional, but they have relief. So many of these fossils preserve soft tissues, and then you can see also very nicely the details of the osteology in the case of vertebrates, or in the case of invertebrate, for instance, insect, you can follow fairly well some very detailed features such as hairs, or how the maxilla end. I mean, also.
So they are bidimensional, but not 100% completely flat.
And then they could also preserve the color in some cases. So, and for the soft tissue, some of the vertebrate preserve the liver. The liver color, and also in some cases we have found bronchioles. I mean the lungs.
Mm-hmm. Right. So I think we've got a pretty good idea of what the environment at Las Hoyas was and how things are preserved. So let's talk about some of the animals that we get there first. So what kinds of groups have we got represented? I mean, we've already spoken about crocodiles, about birds, about salamanders and insects. What else have we got?
Paleocast was brought to you by Dave Marshall, with Joe Keating, Laura Soule, Liz Martin-Silverstone and Caitlin Coleri. It was made possible by funding from the Paleontological Society and the Paleontological Association, but the show now relies on contributions from you, the listeners. If you've liked this episode, please consider donating, and thanks to everyone that's helped out so far. We'd also like to thank the Ocean Collective for use of their music. Please visit paleocast.com for the supplementary material to this episode and for our archive of past programmes. Subscribe to our Twitter feed at paleocast and like us at facebook.com/paleocast to get all the latest news.